It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum number 14. This week we go to Brazil and Austria and Australia and Scotland and Northern Ireland and Orkney. Yeah, I know Orkney's in Scotland, but you'll see why. The United States and Pakistan. And let's begin right there in Pakistan.
اہم خبر شامل کریں گے. سپریم کورٹ نے آسیہ بی بی کو بری کر دیا. چیف جسٹس عاقب نثار نے سزائے موت کے خلاف اپیل پر فیصلہ.
آسیہ بی بی, the Pakistani woman who was under threat of execution because of an accusation of blasphemy, has been freed. She has been found not guilty. Now, this is good news in lots of different ways. Remember that the governor of Punjab province, Salman Taseer, was murdered in 2011 after he spoke in defence of her and after he called for reform of the blasphemy laws. Well, the blasphemy laws haven't been reformed, and if she'd been found guilty, she could have been killed. And her life is very much in danger because some political leaders, have still called for her death and have said they're going to bring the country to a standstill if she was found innocent. Now, we need to think about what that involves. She says that she's prepared to die for her faith, and she may well end up having to do that. But can you imagine a country where you can be executed for criticizing the Prophet Muhammad? Speaking of criticizing Mohammed, let's go to a case that was in the European Court where a woman had appealed against a sentence upon her, Mrs. E.S., because of her criticism of the Prophet Mohammed. Now, initially, the court upheld the Austrian court's ruling and said it was right to fine her. And there has been a general outcry throughout the world from people saying that this is limiting freedom of speech and it means we can't criticize Mohammed. Now, I think it's more subtle than that. And in a very thought-provoking article, Theos Think Tank argued that in fact it wasn't an attack on the freedom of speech and put forward a strong case for that. And yet, ultimately, I think a case that fails. So, here's something from the article. They say the Austrian courts found that people can make offensive attacks on religion, but should avoid making statements that undermine the rights of others or cause major offence to a religious group without contributing to a serious debate of public interest. Now, here's the problem. Whilst Theos are technically correct that there is no law that says you cannot criticise Mohammed, in reality, any criticism of Mohammed will result in a lack of social cohesion. So you print a cartoon in Denmark, you say something here, and it's automatically criticized as Islamophobia. I think Theos are wrong in this. I think that this is actually subtle and yet a very clever way of ensuring that criticizing Mohammed is something that courts throughout Europe, they don't have to do this, but they are going to be permitted to shut down on any speech which is deemed to upset Muslims. And especially in those countries where there are a significant number of Muslims and where there's a threat of militancy, you will see that happening again and again. That's part of where we're at in terms of the left and the liberals in our culture, as well as sometimes the right wing as well. I think it's fear, and I think it's a loss of liberty of speech, and I think in the name of tolerance, we are again ending up being intolerant. Now, speaking of Islam, there's been another famous convert to Islam, the Irish singer Sinead O'Connor.
In the name of Allah, most compassionate, most merciful, we welcome our sister Shuhada, who was previously known as Sinead O'Connor, into the large Muslim family, also known as the Muslim Ummah. You are very welcome, sister. Sister Shuhada has said...
Now, what's fascinating about this in so many different ways, I'm really interested in Sinead O'Connor. I think she's a very troubled soul. She's been pretty ill. She's been pretty mentally ill. And I don't say that as a derogatory thing. Mental illness is something that can affect any one of us. And it's not our fault. But why has she gone this route? I mean, Sinead professes to be a feminist. She famously once ripped up a picture of the Pope because of what she perceived the misogynistic attitudes of the Catholic Church. Well, that's nothing compared to the Quran. And at the risk of being put before the European Court of Human Rights, let me quote from an article from my friend Mark Powell, who's a Presbyterian minister in Australia, who has a regular column in the Australian Spectator. And he's written an article, which we put a link to, about 10 things Sinead O'Connor will need to learn from her new religion. And I'm not going to list all 10, but these are all from the Quran or from Islamic tradition. So, Muhammad said, "After I am gone, the biggest threat to stability that will remain is the harm done to men by women." He also said, "After I die, the biggest problem that I leave to man is woman." He also demanded that a husband's sexual desire must always be met, that a judicial punishment is sometimes different for men and women, and most of all, and this relates to the Austrian case as well, that men can take child brides and have multiple wives. Again quoting, "Mohammed became engaged to Aisha when she was 6 years old. She then went to Medina and stayed at the home of Bani al-Harith, where she got ill and lost her hair. After her hair grew back by the age of 9, her mother handed her to the care of some women who prepared her for her marriage to Muhammad. He consummated his marriage with her when she was 9 years old, and she remained with him for 9 more years until his death." Is that disputed, that happened? And yet, it is justified. He argued that women captured through jihad could be taken as temporary wives. He argued that women should not alter their natural appearances. And he also argued, and this is something that is profoundly disturbing for so many people, that you could beat your wife. And that is in the Quran. "I think, as for those from whom you fear disobedience, admonish them, forsake them in beds apart and beat them. Then if they obey you, take no further action against them." I'm sorry, but Sinead and others have to face up to what Islam actually teaches. Now, it may be that there's a reformed version of Islam. It may be there are other ways around these words. But these are not words that the enemies of Islam have made up. These are words that are in the Islamic teachings, in the Hadith, and in the Quran. And it should not be up to a court, whether in Pakistan, to condemn someone for blasphemy, or whether in Europe to say that you can't say it because it'll upset people. We should be able to speak truth, and we should be able to deal with the facts. Now let's turn to something else. The Pittsburgh massacre of 11 Jewish people in the synagogue there. There are so many aspects of this that are disturbing and that are horrible. I think for me, one of them is just simply that one of the victims was a woman, Rose Malinger, who was aged 97. In other words, she was old enough to remember the Holocaust, to remember a time when Jews were systematically being destroyed by the most civilized nation on earth, and to be killed by a anti-Semitic, to put it mildly, racist, who came in with his gun shouting death to the Jews.
Our security was really just that nobody's ever tried. You know, it was just the fact that nobody ever tried to do anything because, you know, like most religious institutions, we have an open door.
This was an anti-Semitic act. You wouldn't think this would be possible in this day and age. but we just don't seem to learn from the past.
One of the things I've noticed about this is that people are saying, well, this is all because of Donald Trump raising up hate speech and the crude manner in which he speaks. But anti-Semitism is on the rise in Europe. Anti-Semitism is on the rise throughout the world. Death to the Jews is a regular chant in the Middle East. And there will be people who will have celebrated this man doing this. Anti-Semitism is on the rise in the United Kingdom and in Scotland. And to put it bluntly, the number one reason it is on the rise in our area is because of the rise of Islam, which overall is profoundly anti-Jewish. Now, I know that there are those who will deny that, but that is the case. I have been in crowds in Scotland where people are chanting, "From the mountains to the sea, Palestine shall be free." And what they mean is free of Jews. They're not talking about political freedom. They're talking about the destruction of the Jewish state and, to some extent, either the subjugation or the removal of the Jewish people. A second cause in that is that the left-wing and liberals, now right-wing anti-Semitism, which is the guy who appears to have done this, appears to have been on drugs, he appears to have been extremely right-wing, and the far right are a real danger. But the left also, because what's happening with the left and liberals is, although generally saying they are against anti-Semitism, overall there is a pervasive anti-Semitism that is tolerated and an unwillingness to criticize Islam. And we see that in so many ways. There's an SNP councillor in our own country who this week has been suspended from the party for his anti-Semitic blog. This is a problem that will not go away. The Jews have always been hated and they will continue to be hated. We pray for the Jewish people and we support the Jewish people. As we think about where we're at in our culture, let me try and deal with this wonderful question that I was sent from somebody in Australia. As Christians, we don't want to necessarily offend others, but I feel that this often ends up with us conforming to what the PC Brigade demand, using all acceptable terminology and tacitly condoning everything they want, leaving them with full ownership of the public square. At what point and how do we reclaim the public square in everyday conversation? What arguments or activities could we use to defend or reclaim our place? Are there any no-nos? Well, that is such a great question. Thank you, Edwin. I think, of course, there are no-nos. I think that we don't go against what the Bible says. I think we don't express hatred or vehemence towards those whom we disagree. I think we have to express a genuine and show the love of Christ. And also, I think we have to be creative. And so I want to point you to Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah! Nothing means more to me than this game. I would kill for it, I would happily die for it. I wish things were different. But it weren't us who changed.
Trust me, Arthur.
The video game that's enormously popular, it's just come out, Redemption 1, of course, Red Dead Redemption was phenomenally popular. I think selling over £1 billion pounds worth. Well, a church that we love, Charlotte Chapel in Edinburgh, one of their members noticed the advert for Red Dead Redemption 2 and posted up a spoof advert, "Real Life Redemption Through Jesus, Come on Sunday." It was picked up virally, and the Sun newspaper even ran an article on it. That's what I call creative evangelism. Well done to Charlotte. Let's move on to Brazil, where Jair Bolsonaro has won the country's presidential election. Now, what interests me about this is the way that he is described. The New York Times, for example, and the BBC describe him as far right, a strident populist. That may be because of some of his statements, which, if they, as reported, are true, are outrageous. He's exalted the country's military dictatorship. He apparently advocated torture. He's threatened to destroy or drive into exile his political opponents. And so the picture is set up. People, without knowing anything about him, just simply say, oh, he's some kind of far-right dictator. Well, he may be. I don't know enough about him either. But I've been looking up and reading different things, and I notice that there's a tendency that someone who's against same-sex marriage or against abortion, who holds socially conservative views, is automatically held to be far-right. So we've had Jordan Peterson in Scotland this week, and people automatically dismiss him as far-right, which is ridiculous. Now, I'll tell you why it's ridiculous. Because what happens is, if the liberal elites automatically dismiss anyone who disagrees with any of their views as being far right, what they end up doing is driving social conservatives towards the far right. If you keep calling people names, then you're going to push that. And I think that's what's happened. You're finding that people have been elected to power in Hungary and in Poland, and that populist right-wing parties are rising. And I think there's a danger here to Christianity too. I'm not saying this about Mr. Bolsonaro because I don't know enough about him. I'm told that he is a Pentecostal Christian, which incidentally would make the President of Brazil and the Prime Minister of Australia both Pentecostal Christians. Is this the rise of the Pentecostals? But I think there's a danger for the church here as well. I think in our reaction against the liberal elites, sometimes we can overlook the fact that some of the people who would claim our support, who want our support, who might even use language of pro-family, anti-abortion, and so on, that they may actually be extremely unpleasant characters and extremely far-right. Now, again, please note, I'm not saying that about Mr. Bolsonaro or indeed anyone else. I just think we need to be incredibly careful. Bottom line is, I don't trust politicians. So I was in Northern Ireland this week, and, you know, there's the ongoing hassle with the hate police and the troubles that we've had with that, and I've continued to write about this on the blog. But one thing struck me in Northern Ireland. I was there speaking in the Presbyterian Church, which has begun to return, I think, to a much more biblical foundation. And not least, it stood up to society on the issue of same-sex marriage. Now, this has not been universally welcomed within the church. And so, for example, the clerk of May Street Presbyterian Church in Belfast has reported his own denomination, the Presbyterian Church, to the Charity Commission to see if the PCI is breaching equality legislation by restricting membership. He says this: "This decision excludes people from being voting members of congregations, presbyteries, and the General Assembly. It places an unreasonable restriction on the membership of the congregation." Now, do you see what is happening here? Here is someone from the church saying that the state has the right to determine the membership of the church and the voting rights of the church. No, the state doesn't, and we will not go down that tyrannical route, and it is a tyrannical route. Meanwhile, we pray for the church in Northern Ireland. It is possible that Union Seminary, their theological college and one of the best known in the world, could be disaffiliated from Queen's University because of the stance of the denomination. Well, so be it. That's the price we pay for being faithful. Now, speaking of an authoritarian state, I want you to have a listen to this short clip of the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon.
As First Minister, I have many, many, many different responsibilities, but there is no responsibility that I have that is more important than my responsibility as the chief corporate parent in Scotland. Chief mammy, as I prefer to describe it.
What she's doing, it sounds so chilling at first, and that's why we need to look into this a little bit more detail. The corporate mammy. I mean, imagine Donald Trump saying, "I'm the corporate daddy for the people of the United States." Well, corporate parent is a legal term, and Nicola was speaking, the First Minister was speaking at an event which is seeking to look at how children in care are looked after. And as the First Minister, there are 24 bodies that are named as corporate parents in Scotland who are responsible for children under care and in other circumstances. So, in a sense, she was saying, it's really important for me, and I think it's highly commendable, actually, that she was there, and I think it's highly commendable that she does seem to genuinely care about the children who are in care. However, the language is still chilling, because I do think that there's a corporatism and an authoritarianism creeping in. I do think that there is a move within Scotland and with other governments to see the state as primary parents, not parents. Now, of course, the state needs to intervene when parents are not doing their job, when parents are abusive, when parents break the law. But when you start seeing the state as corporate parents, and you have a corporate mommy, there's something profoundly disturbing and profoundly authoritarian in that. Well, let's leave you with a quote of the week in an article from John Anderson, the former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, who I once did an interview with. It's a brilliant article in The Australian about the dangers of a kind of authoritarian secularism driving religion, and especially Christianity, out of public life. He quotes Sir Robert Menzies, who said this: "Democracy is more than a machine, it is a spirit. It is based upon the Christian conception that there is in every human soul a spark of the divine. For Menzies, democracy could work only if we remember that, with all their inequalities of mind and body, the souls of men stand equal in the sight of God." That is the foundation of our democracy. As we've seen in this week's podcast, we remove that, we are not going to end up with equality and diversity. We are going to end up with some kind of authoritarianism. Whether it is right-wing or left-wing is largely irrelevant. It will have the same effect. So, thank you again for listening. Thank you to the 40 patrons at the time of recording who've signed up to support this. It is really, really appreciated. And you should be encouraged, because throughout the world, more and more people are speaking up, and we are linking together. Just as at the time of the Reformation, the printing press became a tool to spread the gospel and to challenge the evils within this world, so I believe that the internet, though it can be used for evil, as the printing press could, the internet is setting us free from this corporate state control. And we have this marvelous opportunity to spread the good news of Christ. So thank you again, and hopefully we shall see you again next week. God bless you.
Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge, and oddly enough, but makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand, because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it, or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christian